The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Dose of Leadership podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and educational interviews with today's most relevant and motivating leaders. Each episode is dedicated to highlight real-life leadership and influence experts who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the truth, common sense, and courageous leadership. And now, here's your host, Richard Ryerson.
Hey, welcome to Dose of Leadership. So happy you're tuning in to another episode. This is the show that helps you in your leadership journey, a great free resource to help you become the best leader that you can possibly become. I mean, I'm on the journey with you, and we do that by exploring the topics of leadership, talking to great guests, exploring the leadership entrepreneurial mindset in an effort to maybe learn something that we can take away and become better leaders ourselves. And this episode today, this conversation, chock full of great advice and mindset from the one and only Bill Rasmussen. Bill was the founder. He's the father of cable sports. He founded ESPN in September 7th, 1979. He's an Air Force veteran. He was an aspiring baseball star, but the Korean War got him drafted, and he went into the Air Force, and then he became an entrepreneur, or started working for Westinghouse and became an entrepreneur, and eventually, in the late 70s, launched ESPN. And it's something we take for granted, but he's the one that really brought, you know, the wall-to-wall coverage of the NCAA regular season basketball, the March Madness, all of that, the coverage of the College World Series. He broke the advertising barrier to cable television by signing Anheuser-Busch to the largest cable TV advertising contract ever. And what I love about Bill is his mindset about life, and it's something that I've tried to do day in and day out, but it's saying yes and then figuring out the details later. And Bill, as he talks about in the interview, he does things on a whim, but it's smart risk, and it's exercising his talent, and it's not letting his fear override his not willing, or override his willingness to try. And for him, if you don't try, you're never going to find anything out. And his life has been the perfect example of that, which led to not only ESPN, but him to become, you know, a sports broadcaster with no experience. The list goes on and on. I'll let you listen to it in the interview. But I really love Bill and what he stands for. And as leaders, we can all learn something from him. So again, let me know where you're at in your leadership journey. Reach out to me at richardryerson.com or doseofleadership.com. You can find a contact page. I answer every single email. It may take me a while, but I promise you I will get back to you. Just let me know where you're at. I'm always helping people with their leadership questions and advice. And of course, you can check out my services at richardryerson.com, my speaking, my coaching, my masterminding. All of that's available there at richardryerson.com. And of course, my Legacy Leader Blueprint course, which is a course perfect for organizations who are looking to take, I don't know, maybe 5 to 10 of their up-and-coming high performers and dive into the concept of leadership on my online video course, plus personal mentoring sessions with me. You can learn all about that at richardryerson.com or doseofleadership.com. Just click on the Legacy Leader Blueprint. You can watch a video there that'll tell you all about the course. And for $349 a seat, it will not break the bank or the company's budget. And it'll help you become more influential leaders. I promise you that. All right. So without further ado, here is the father of cable sports and ESPN, Bill Rasmussen, on Dose of Leadership. Well, Bill, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Welcome to Dose of Leadership.
Thanks, Richard. Looking forward to chatting with you this morning.
Yeah, likewise. I'm so excited when you accepted this offer. You know, obviously growing up as a child, I was born in 1968, and I remember when ESPN hit the airwaves. I remember that day in September of 79. And
You're one of the few people who does these days, because the numbers are becoming less and less. I realized the other day, for example, almost every player in every major league sport has no idea what life was like before ESPN. They've all been, you know, ESPN's now 38 years old.
Right.
Or will be next month. There aren't many pro athletes older than 38.
I remember sitting there with my, and we had just got cable. I mean, cable was brand new to us then. And, you know, of course, growing up from 68 to 79 in the year that we got cable, you know, having the three channels, four channels if you counted PBS, you know, and I was the remote control, right? And Dad telling me to get off the couch and change the channel or whatever. But
that's right. And I remember those days.
And I remember my dad saying, he's like, what are they going to show for 24 hours? You know, now look at it. You can't imagine life without 24-hour news, sports, or anything almost.
Yeah, that was a question we heard a lot those days, Richard. It was the first 6, 8, 9 months. Everybody said it's never going to work. Who's going to do that? What's going to, you know, nobody's going to want to watch that many sports. Well, at that point there were 12 bowl games. Now last bowl season, I think ESPN televised 35 to 36 bowl games.
Wow.
Football on television between the big three in those days. You mentioned just the three big networks and PBS. Football was probably 25 games a season. They'd have two on some Saturdays and a bonus every now and then. And you always saw the same teams, you know, Texas and Alabama and Oklahoma, Michigan, USC, Notre Dame. That's just the way it was. And we said, well, there's more than that. We can show a lot more games than that. 24 hours. I don't know where this, we came up with this comment. We had a statistic, we said, in quotes, statistic. At least not everybody works 9 to 5. You know, there are people who work 11 to 7. There are people who work 3 to 11. And there's somebody watching. We came up with this figure. There are at least 1 million people watching television at any given hour, 24 hours a day. Nobody could question it because there was no television that went overnight at that point. All
right.
The three networks, if you recall, signed off at 1 o'clock.
Yep, I remember.
And so people looked at us like, where did they get that statistic? And we just barged ahead in the conversation. You know, let's not worry too much about the details and the validation at that point.
Right.
And they, of course, back when we went on the air, and I don't know if you remember or if your dad said anything to you, we were not allowed to televise any football games live because the big three had a contract with the NCAA. And we could tape and play something at 10:30 at night, but that was all we can do.
Wow.
And actually, Barry Switzer at Oklahoma and, I think it was Bobby Dodd, or I'm not sure who it was at Georgia Tech, brought a lawsuit. They wanted their game shown live. They didn't want to be restricted to the NCAA or whoever was ruling their television in those days. Had a ruling that no more than one team could appear no more than three times in the season. And Barry Switzer said, everybody wants to see Oklahoma every game. So they actually filed an antitrust action. And by 1984, it had worked its way through the courts. And just in August of 1984, the ruling came down and all of the network contracts were voided just 3 or 4 weeks before the season started. And everybody who had ever dreamed of televising a football game live started televising in September, and of course ESPN was right on top of it, and off we went.
Yeah,
live football has never been the same.
Well, I tell you, from my parents were a sports family, and I am up until even when my dad passed away in 2010. I mean, ESPN was on constantly in our household, and so it was a staple in our household. And it's fun to hear how it began. But I'm the things that struck me about you and why I wanted to talk to you, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, is that it's struck out to me as I look at your career and how you got to this point, is that you always said yes and tried to figure out the details later, something that I try to subscribe to. I think that's where the richness of life comes in. How did you develop that mentality? If you can think back, did it go back to your childhood, to when you were playing sports? I mean, when did it start for you?
Well, I think it actually, I was born in the 30s, so that, you know, we all lived through World War II. I was in the fourth grade on December 7th, 1941. And so I was very much aware of what was happening. And we went through rationing, gasoline rationing, food rationing, blackouts, air raid drills. I mean, we did all those things. And my father always said, you know, we're going to get through this. Don't worry about it. We're going to make it. We're going to, you know, and he did everything he could. He started out as a banker and then things changed and he ended up being a conductor on a streetcar and then he ended up selling insurance. But he said, I'll always keep food on the table. You can always make those things happen. And I guess that's probably where it started. And then I, I was absolutely certain I was going to play third base for the Chicago White Sox by the time I, you know, graduated from college or high school, one or the other. But the Korean conflicts started June 25th, 1950, the very day I graduated from high school.
Oh, my gosh.
So that ended all of those things because everybody went in the military and or to college and the military or straight to military. So I went to college and was in the Air Force ROTC. While I was in high school, the Army ROTC was a very strong program in high schools across the country. Coming right out of World War II, you would expect that, I guess. And then got out of the Air Force, got out of college, and it was time to go on active duty. And I actually, in November 1956, went on active duty with the Air Force.
Wow.
So, you know, there were two things in my father, and I think everybody kind of had the same feeling, especially during the war. It was patriotism, and coming out of this, we're going to be stronger than ever, and we can do anything we want.
Yeah.
And it kind of stuck with me, and I always thought I could do anything I wanted, except when I came out of the Air Force, way too old to start thinking about playing baseball, and I
right.
was married and had my first son, and so I went to work for Westinghouse, and I don't know, I guess I'm one of those people who always looked at something and said, I think I can do this a little better, or why are we doing it that way? It doesn't seem right. Let's see if we can do this. And so I had some suggestions at Westinghouse, and they had a program, an advertising program, that they would send all kinds of material. This was the retail division, the Westinghouse lamp division. They would send all sorts of corrugated stands and advertising materials and plans, incentive plans for the salesmen across the country. But to ship the product, it had to go through a union shop at the headquarters in Bloomfield, New Jersey. And they would only send so many a day, and people in the field were complaining. They had a meeting, and the material arrived 14 weeks later.
Oh, my gosh.
Or 12 weeks later. And so I said, there's got to be a better way. And so I talked to the advertising manager and said, I'm going to quit and start a company, but you have to agree to be my first customer. And they were. And so in 1959, I started a company called Ad Aid, Inc.
Right.
Where we came up with that name, I have no idea, because we were just going to aid the advertisers, I guess.
Right. And so you were providing all the marketing, the POP materials and everything for a sales
and shipping
force.
The big thing was we guaranteed them whenever any order came in for any of those materials, it would be in motion within 24 hours toward its destination. In those days, in motion didn't mean FedEx because it hadn't been invented.
Right.
It was U.S. mail, parcel post, or Emory Air Freight was the quickest way we could get something done. I don't think Emory Air Freight's around anymore. I'm not even sure. You might know.
I remember the name, but I don't know if they still are around or not.
I think probably it got swallowed up along the way. But anyway, I said, let's do this. And he said, okay. And so I can remember how quickly it happened. And in rapid order, we rented a little space. We didn't know how busy it was going to be. We rented 800 square feet in an abandoned storefront right near the plant. Less than a month later, we rented 2,500 more square feet more. And by October, we took part of a warehouse for 15,000 square feet.
Was this primarily for using Westinghouse, or did you have other clients at this time?
It was primarily for Westinghouse, but we were talking to other people at the same time. We found that we were in a business area where the warehouse was, and we thought we'd do business with some of the small businesses up and down, and we found out that's not a very good path to victory, so to speak. So we went to General Electric and S&H Green Stamps and General Foods. And with what we were doing at Westinghouse, they all jumped on board. And the way that we did it, Richard, was really kind of unique. And if we had patented the idea, maybe we'd still be around today. It lasted for about 50 years. But we got literally a roster of housewives and young men who were available at odd times. I mean, you know, a housewife could take the kids to school and work 3 hours or come in after her husband came home in the evening or whatever. And we worked from 7 in the morning till 7 at night with basically all part-time people.
Wow.
And if they could make it, we'd just, you know, big order would come in and we'd get somebody would, we had the person who would get on the phone and just start calling down a list. And if you said you couldn't work today, it didn't make any difference. It didn't put you in a bad light. We'd call you again the next time. And so we were able to turn out huge volumes, big, big jobs. And the more big jobs that we turned out on time, the word spread, and it became a very successful business.
That's interesting.
But I retired from that, though.
Yeah.
Fortunately.
I'll get to that in a second, but I'm curious if you realized, it's amazing to me that you basically, you know, went through high school, went to college, you know, essentially went into the military, and then you started, worked at one place, and then you started a business. And so it just seems this entrepreneurial mindset, I mean, it's kind of been inherent in you, with you, this idea is like, I can always do it better. I can figure out a way. I'll say yes and figure it out later. Did you realize you were an entrepreneur at that point? I mean, had you felt like you made it?
I don't think I knew that word, but, but I knew what I wanted to do.
Right. Yeah. So you it's interesting that you have this pretty successful business right out of the gate. And your first client was a company that you worked for, the first company you worked for out of the military. But then you decided you wanted to get into broadcasting, which I found fascinating because obviously I love broadcasting. I was a broadcasting major originally at Wichita State. But you decided, hey, you know what? I can't play baseball. I'm going to at least be a broadcaster. Was that always a dream that you'd had?
Yeah. Once I got out of the Air Force and realized I couldn't play, I really did start thinking about broadcasting. Fortunately, I was in the New Jersey area, and in those days, Major League Baseball was a little less organized than it is today, and the Giants, Dodgers, and Yankees all played in New York many times on the same day on different channels, Channel 9 or Channel 11. You know, now they play, if the Yankees are home, the Mets are on the road, and vice versa. But one of the voices we heard, of course, was Vin Scully with the Dodgers. He started back, amazingly, back in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And so I decided I love baseball and I couldn't play, but I could broadcast. And so that's kind of what I had in mind, even when I went to work for Westinghouse. The dream just didn't die. An odd little story that goes with that. While I was working at Westinghouse in 1954, World Series was between the Cleveland Indians and the New York Giants. And the shortstop for the Cleveland Indians was Sam Denti. And one day I was sitting in the office at Westinghouse. This would probably be 1957 or 8. And the advertising manager said, hey, we got this guy coming in from a mailing house. We have to talk to him because we're going to do this big, whatever the project was. And I said, fine. He came in and introduced himself. And he said, hi, I'm Sam Denti. And I said, not Sam Denti. He said, oh, I'm the one. I get that a lot. And he was the shortstop, because even in the 1950s, most major leaguers had to have an off-season job, even guys that played in the World Series.
Right.
Just incredible compared to what they have today.
So when you decided to get that first job, that broadcasting job, how did that start? I mean, if I remember correctly, if I was reading that you had saw an ad in a broadcasting magazine, is that correct?
Yep. I think today it's broadcasting and cable, but back then it was just broadcasting magazine. Yeah, they used to run these small, you know, 2 or 3 line ads saying sportscaster needed, West Sterling, Rhode Island, call such and such, or newscast, you know, whatever it was. So I saw one in West Sterling, Rhode Island, and I called the guy and said I'd come up and see him, and he said, sure, come on up, let's talk. Fortunately, he didn't ask me anything on the phone because I had nothing to say on the phone. I had no background
right.
or anything.
No experience.
But I figured this was really part of the yes, I can do this method. And I had decided that I was going to do something by my 30th birthday. And this was the only interview I ever had for radio. I got in the car, lived in Clifton, New Jersey, drove to West Philly, Rhode Island. And after the, you know, good morning and how are you and so on, he said, well, did you bring a tape? And I said, no.
Oh, my God.
And he said, no tape? Well, what station do you work for? I said, I've never worked at a radio station. He said, what are you talking about? You came here to be, you're applying for a sportscaster's job, and now you tell me no tape and no station. I said, that's right. He said, well, why would I hire you? I said, because I can do it. He looked at me for a second. He said, I'll tell you what. we're putting a new station on the air in Amherst, Massachusetts. If you'll move to Amherst to help me put that station on the air, you're my sportscaster. That's how I started.
Wow.
But went on the air April 1st, 1963. Had never spoken a word on the radio, and they never been employed anywhere on the radio. But what's so hard about saying, you know, last night, April 1st, baseball season was getting underway, and talk a little bit about the beginning of the baseball season and local sports where Amherst, Mass. Is the home of the University of Massachusetts. So it was pretty easy to put something together. The part he didn't tell me is that I would be the sportscaster, but everybody that was on the air was also selling advertising when they weren't on the air.
Right.
So I was an advertising salesman, and I did know a little bit about that from the Westinghouse days and, you know, things that you absorb talking to salespeople and so on.
So did it meet
you? That's how it started, 1963.
I love
off
that.
I went.
Having that confidence and just saying, hey, yeah, I can do this. And the guy saw something in that. No one's ever had that craziness or courage, I guess. He probably was just like, who is this guy? That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, one of the fun things that grew out of that after we went on the air April 1st, and being a sports fan, I said, you know, his name was Augie, whatever the last name was. I remember his first name was Augie. I said, hey, Augie, we got to do some football games. And he wasn't much of a sports fan. He said, yeah, I suppose so. I said, why don't I go to the University of Massachusetts and find out who to talk to, and we'll see where we go from there. And he said, sure, go ahead. So I found the athletic director and went up and introduced myself. And I said, Warren McGurk was his name. I'll never forget him. Big ex-football player. I said, Mr. McGurk, we're the new station in town. We'd like to broadcast all of your football games. They only played like 9 games in those days, unlike they do today. He said, oh, great idea. Go ahead. No rights fee, no contract, no anything. Just go ahead and do the games. So we said, okay. So we went back to Augie and I said, yeah, we can do the games. First one's in Oro, Maine. And radio with those days was a telephone line from AT&T, and they put an installation wherever the game was, and, you know, you could broadcast back to your station. The part that I hadn't told anybody was I had, you know, it's the continuation of really the first interview. Obviously, I'd never broadcast a football game because I hadn't done any sportscasting.
Oh, on
the way. So we're on the way to Maine, and the University of Massachusetts Athletic sports information director was going to do the color and, you know, keep me up to date
right.
with who was doing what and so on, as they do today. And all the way to Maine, an 8-hour drive, and I kept saying, should I tell him that I've never done this before or not? Should
oh
I tell
God.
Him? Nah, I said, I'm just going to wing it. And I did. Never did tell him that was the first game I had ever done.
That's crazy. How did you prepare for that? Did you do any preparation?
I prepared by imagining what the real broadcasters would do. They would get the roster and they'd go down and they would, you know, memorize the starting players, find out as much information as you can about them, and then rely on the fellow from the SID's office for all the, you know, detailed statistics. And it was just, I put together my version, if you will, of a depth chart that I could refer to while the game was underway. But, you learn the quarterbacks and the ends and the running backs, the linebackers. And I fortunately, I've been blessed with a really, really good memory for many, many years. As far back as I can go, as I can remember, I could read things and they would stick with me. So it was, I did a lot of it on a wing and a prayer, Richard, to be honest about it, but it was.
Yeah, but it was
a calculated risk.
Right. It was smart risk. It wasn't like, well, I'm just going to try to figure this out. I mean, you did some preparation, like you said, you've been blessed with the great memory. And so doing some study, but I love what you said there about the playing it out in your head, the playing out the movie in your head beforehand. I'm a big fan of that, you know, kind of seeing you or kind of manifesting what you see you become. Type of thing.
Exactly.
Almost. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so do you do that with everything?
I'm afraid I do. I just try to, I've heard the phrase, just as you said just now, it's kind of like a movie playing out and let's see how it's going to work. Sometimes a movie doesn't always work out the way you think it is, but yeah, that's always kind of, I can imagine, I think of it as imagining this is going to happen, then we can make that happen. And then when we get that in place, we can go out and do the next step. And for some reason, and I don't know where that comes from, or I didn't go to school and take a class in that. I don't think there is such a class. I don't know.
No. Yeah.
But I just, you know, one of them is I know I can do it.
Yeah.
And if you have the right mindset and you know you can do it, and you never, never, never stop until somebody proves you cannot do it, or you go ahead and do it.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest things, you know, doing this show 4.5 years and 300 plus interviews, the theme that always comes out in these conversations, that it's so less to do about the talent. You know, talent's kind of the given, but it's more about the tenacity and the kind of the suspending the belief in how things are going to get done. You just know they're going to get done. And
yep.
And that is always seems to me to be the thing that drives people over the goal line, where, you know, 95, 98, 99 people will get to the 1 yard line. But to get it across the goal line, it's the person that never gives up, the person that
right.
never quits.
Well, I learned, and I tell this story frequently when I speak at college campuses, or even at I can remember telling it one time at a football coach asked me to come in and talk to the team just before the kickoff. He said, just some message to inspire them. And the thing, I was playing baseball, obviously, in high school and college and so on, and summer leagues, and one summer league, and it was 1952 or three. I was pretty fast in my day and had never been caught stealing ever in this one season, which is unheard of. I mean, it's a statistic nobody would ever know about but me, but I was pretty proud of that. I could, anytime I wanted to steal a base, I'd steal it, and I know I could make it. We're playing the last game of the season, and I thought, oh, well, just steal second base. Why not? And guess what? I would steal second base, and I would be whatever number of stolen bases all through the season I would have without ever being caught. And I knew I had it stolen, and I let up for just a second before I started to slide. I was congratulating myself before the job was done.
Right.
And you know the outcome. The ball arrived out, done. That was it. And telling that story to you right now, I still can feel that same feeling I had then. That I'm never, ever going to stop until I get as far as I can go. And I either physically can't go any farther or, you know, whatever the block. But as long as I can think about it, I'm going to give it 100% until I succeed or fail. And I mentioned that story in a little bit of a different context for football. This team went out and they scored 3 touchdowns in the first 7 minutes in the wife of the athletic director turned to me and said, what did you say to those guys before the game? I said, I don't think that had anything to do with it. They're pretty good football players.
But
that attitude, excuse me, that attitude, I think, pays off. If you can't give up. If you give up without seeing it to the very end, win or lose at the end, you'll never know. Would I have made it if I kept going? Sure, I would have.
Right. But at least you know you gave everything, you laid it all on the field.
Right.
Yeah. And I think the important thing to realize about that is that that is the one thing you have complete 100% control of. That is 100% choice. And I think
exactly.
That... Exactly. And when you realize that, then you realize that you have way more influence and power than we give ourselves credit for. Because
yep.
I think we look at too many of external circumstances thinking and blaming this or worrying about this or worrying about the obstacle, but it's really the obstacle really is the way. And just like in that story, that obstacle or that kind of in your own mind, that personal failure, no one else probably, you know, everybody else has probably long forgot about that stolen base that you failed
to get. I think anybody else even thought about it for a second.
Right.
You know? I mean, it was just the way it was.
But that was your obstacle, and that obstacle became your way. And that's what defined you. And I think that's what we need to kind of look at those obstacles or those failures or those stumbles as blessings. Because if you look at them that way, they actually develop your character and who you actually can become. I don't know. That's the way
they become great assets.
Right. I love
that
story.
One of the things that someone... I think it was when I was at the Whalers, it was someone from WTIC Hartford. We were talking about all the things we were going to do with the Whalers. This is before ESPN began in the mid-1970s. And he said, it might have been the sales manager. And he said, I want to tell you something. It's a philosophy that I have in the sales business. And I'm always willing to listen and learn. And he said, when you put together a plan that's well thought out and you take it and present it to somebody and they say, no, we can't do that, and they show you the door, just don't think of it as a failure on your part. Think that they've just missed a great opportunity.
Right.
And they have. And that's mm-hmm. that's really the way we went at ESPN. And we started talking to major investors. And Getty was the seventh one we talked to before we got somebody to invest any money. All of the others, and I remembered thinking of what that fellow had said. And in my mind, all of the others made him, they made a mistake, not me.
Yeah.
That's fine. Thank you very much. And courteous. I mean, I'm not going to scream and holler at them.
No.
But they did make a mistake.
Right. And it's having that internal kind of, again, suspending the belief on how it's going to happen. You just know it's going to happen. You know, despite what despite your feelings, you just know that it's going to happen in some way. I'm a huge believer of that.
And I feel that way to this day. I don't have any, there's not an ESPN or anything that big, but other things that I'm doing, I think they're all going to turn out fine. They don't always all turn out fine. And when that happens, you just have to accept it and go on. But that's the way you have to start. If you don't start that way, you're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah, one thing that I was completely really blown away by was the time frame of ESPN. I guess in my mind, I would think it'd be this lifelong vision and dream that you always had, but it almost came about by a mistake, a firing. And here it was in 1978, if I get my timing correct, when you got essentially fired from the Whalers in early spring of 78. And then just through kind of like some quirk conversations, and then here we are in September of 79, we're launching this network on this satellite, which you didn't even know anything about, but it just happened through these kind of weird, quirky conversations in 1978. In less than a year and a half, you launched this from conception to going live, which is just remarkable to me.
I look back on that, and I don't know how it happened either, but we just kept going seemingly 24/7 days a week. The firing came on Saturday, Memorial Day weekend, and by the end of June, on June 25th, we had a press conference talking about this crazy idea that we had.
Oh, my God.
And we incorporated in Hartford, Connecticut on Bastille Day, July 14th, 1978. So from Saturday, Memorial Day weekend, through a press conference, through a lot of conversations, through everybody saying, we can get this done, we said, well, we better go incorporate it, and we did. And July 14th, and then my daughter worked and was 16 years old, working at a restaurant at the shore where we had gone down in New Jersey for many years. And August 16th, my son Scott and I were going down to a birthday party. This is August 16th, 1978, which was, June, July, about 2.5 months after being fired. And on the way down, we were talking about what are we going to do. We got this great idea and so on. And we had heard about the satellite by that time. We had a cable operator turned us on to RCA. And we found out, figured out what we were talking about, transponders, not satellites. The satellite has 24 transponders. And when they got that into my head, I was off and running.
Right.
And so while we were driving to and from New Jersey, we basically put together the entire concept of ESPN right down to a 30-minute sports show that turned out to be called Sports Center. We called it Sports Central that day on August 16th, went on the air as Sports Center in 1979. So really, after that, it was just a question of who we're going to convince to buy this and invest in it and so on. And where are we going to get all the programming? Everybody said there simply isn't that much programming available. But I found a statistic that said the preceding year, school year, the NCAA, all of the NCAA schools had sanctioned 116,000 events.
Wow.
Well, if they sanctioned 116,000 events, and if they were all 2 hours, that'd be 232,000 hours. And we only needed 8,760 hours of programming. So there were plenty of things to televise.
Right.
And 8,760 hours, and everybody said, what are you going to do for a full year? And pretty soon, of course, as you well know, along came ESPN2 and ESPN News right. and all of the other networks. There's plenty of sports. It has become just a major, major business. But it was fun putting it together and hearing all the people that said no, and many of them came later and said, you know, I should have listened the first time. And a couple of people actually laughed the first time and came later and said, remember when you came to meet us? Where were we wrong? But to me, it wasn't that they were wrong. They just didn't have the same vision I did, that's all.
Yeah. What about the getting, you were talking a little bit how you went to Getty and got some financing, and what was that like? Was that a juggling act of spinning plates? I mean, how did that come to fruition?
That's a good analogy. You just used the spinning plates. I lived at a condominium community in Connecticut. It was sold because whoever the developer was had to get out. And it was purchased by Fidelity Insurance in Philadelphia. All of this is by way of background. One of the people working at Fidelity was a gentleman, in effect, a small investment firm. And so I would see him, and he came up one time when I was working at the Whalers, and he said, you know, can you help me promote this new property that we just have? And can you get some hockey players to come out? Well, hockey players, if they're going to get a free round of golf, they'll go anywhere.
Right.
So we flooded the course, and they brought a lot of prospects out, and, you know, and it seemed to be pretty successful. And I had forgotten about it. I didn't, you know, that was back in my hockey days. And I thought, I wonder if Tom's still around. I'm just going to give him a call. So I called him, and I remember it was like 10:45 at night. And I started talking, and he didn't say anything. And at the end of the conversation, 10 or 15 minutes later, he said, can you call my office in the morning? I said, sure. And I thought, well, that's encouraging, but I didn't exactly know why. And so I called him the next morning, and he said, I want you to talk to this gentleman, J.B. Doherty. Tell him what you told me last night. So I told him, and he said, J.B. then said, can you come down to our office tomorrow morning? So I thought, wow, something. We've struck a chord somewhere. Well, turns out I had a very receptive audience. They had just been engaged by RCA Americom to help promote their satellite business and transponder sales because they were lagging. So, you know, just serendipitous that I happened to live in a place that somebody couldn't pay for. Developer went out of business. Insurance company steps in. Guy leaves the insurance company, starts a small investment firm, and it comes full circle. And they then said, okay, we'll line up some advertisers, have some potential investors for you to go visit. And we visited with Pittsburgh Plate Glass, Mellon Bank, Campbell Soup's Venture Foundation, a couple of individual investors, high net worth individuals. And then December, on a rainy night, I went to visit the TV committee chairman, Captain Bo Coppedge, at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, because we had been working with the NCAA as well to try and get their interest going. And every time I would finish a meeting, I would call JB and give him the process, you know, what progress, whatever it was. And it was a rainy night. I was at the airport, and he said, you know, we're running out of people to talk to. He said, but if you're game, can you be in Los Angeles on Monday morning to meet Getty Oil? So I guess it must have been in Baltimore. So I flew home, got another ticket, took off on Sunday night, flew to Los Angeles, moved into the Marriott Hotel. They had a fire at 2 a.m, evacuated the hotel. I was awake all night and met with Getty Oil the next morning. And from that moment on, just took off. And Valentine's Day, 1979, Getty Oil called me. I was visiting the Walter Byers at the NCAA offices in Kansas City. And Mr. Byers' secretary came in and said, excuse me, but Mr. Rasmussen has a call. And it turned out to be Getty Oil saying, we've decided to go ahead and invest in your company idea. And it was the same day that the NCAA said, yes, we're going to go ahead. And we ended up signing a contract with the NCAA on March 1st for all of their programming, and Getty Oil and started funding us and sent their finance manager out, and he brought his checkbook with him, and away we went.
Wow.
From being fired to having the NCAA sign and Getty Oil on board and several cable operators already on board was only about 10 months.
That is just insanity. That's crazy.
Yeah, I think about that myself, and I remember getting on a lot of airplanes.
I can imagine.
And back in those, and this is probably long before you would remember flying such things, people could smoke cigars and pipes on the air, and you could do anything.
Yeah.
Somebody would say, well, the smoking row is 15 and back or whatever. Well, if you're sitting in 14 or 12,
you're still in the smoking section. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I remember flying on planes back in the 70s and even in the 80s, you could still smoke on the planes. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy stuff.
That's just,
but it was interesting how many the Pac-10 back then, that was, now it's Pac-12. I went to a meeting to visit with them, and they politely said, even though I'd gone all the way there, they were meeting in Phoenix, and I flew to Phoenix to meet with them, and I walked in, and they said, you know, we've been thinking about it, and we don't think your idea is going to work. Thank you for coming. Mm. Of course, now the Pac-12 gets $20 to $40 million a year from ESPN.
Wow. In those early days, where were you on September 7th? What was that like? I mean, were you in this? Obviously, you're in the studio, but I mean, what was that moment like when the?
Well, it was really kind of interesting. We cut it pretty close. The contract, we still didn't have bathrooms. The control room was a dummy control room because we had to host all the people from Budweiser were there, Getty Oil, the NCAA, they were all there. But we really were running it out of a remote truck outside the studio.
Oh, so you really, you didn't have it. You were cabling in from a remote truck. Your studio wasn't even done.
Yeah. We went on the air from a remote truck. We went to the. But we had a guy sitting at the controls in the control room, you know, looking through the glass at the studio where everybody was doing their thing. Lee Leonard and George Grant did their opening comments and so on. But nobody in the control room knew it wasn't working because nobody's ever been in the control room. You know, it's not like today where everybody knows. I mean, 10-year-olds do video today, but back then that wasn't the case. We wanted to show everybody how the satellite worked, and we had Chuck Fairbanks, former coach of the Patriots, who is now the Colorado coach. We had him in Boulder, Colorado, at the middle of the field. And at 6:55, we checked everything. It worked. And as soon as we went to demonstrate it live, we could see him talking, but we couldn't hear anything. So right out of the chute, we had a problem. But everybody chuckled, and we got past it. It was the real tense moments came, I think, earlier in the day as we had to do different things to get ready for the night. But by the time we got to 6:30 or so, it was just watching, and everybody was kind of wandering around, and one of the maintenance men was cleaning our glass walls in the hallway, taking his time about it, and people were running back and forth with things for the sports center that we were going to do and so on.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to him, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm just finishing my job. I'll be done here. You know? And he just taking his time. Everybody had their own role that night, but it was exciting, and the exciting part is we went all the way through until early Monday morning. We went on Friday night, stayed on all through Saturday and Sunday until early Monday morning, and nobody had ever gone 24 hours, none of the big networks, no matter what the tragedy or anything. I remember working at the NBC station in Springfield the night Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and also the night that Richard Nixon resigned.
Right.
And the networks went to 1 o'clock and said, thank you, you know, here's our national anthem, and we'll be back. It was, just, you know, just went to test pattern. That's all there was to it.
Yeah.
And we went some 70, I don't know how many hours, 60-some odds, almost 72 hours. And nobody's ever done that. Of course, we showed a lot of the same things twice. But that was kind of the idea that, you know, if you were watching and you had to go to bed at 9 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night, But somebody who just came in at 11 o'clock, they had something to watch for the first time in their life.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the first time, too, that I saw a cross-country match televised, which I thought was interesting. And and I just love it. And again, go ahead. What were you going to say?
We did a lot of strange things. We had pool contests.
Right.
And I guess they still have poker contests.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. All kinds of stuff. Yeah. I always wondered if, you know, what the major networks, particularly like Wide Wilder Sports and ABC and NBC Sports, were they looking at you as kind of a threat? Was there a condescension, you know, towards looking at you? I mean, what was the feeling like, especially those early years?
Condescension capitalized.
Yeah.
We were stupid. We were inexperienced. We were not the networks or anything. I'll give you a prime example of the way the entire industry was very close-knit. And people kept calling saying, why can't we find you in TV Guide? Why can't we find, you know, what program's coming out? What game is coming up this weekend? So obviously we were talking to TV Guide. And I asked the same question. We wanted to know why. And finally, a vice president, believe it or not, I don't know what he was paid, but he was a vice president, said, well, we can't list you because real networks only have three letters.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. Real networks only have three letters. So it took a couple of years before they finally started listing us. And you know how they listed us?
How?
ESN.
Oh, my God.
Because we've become real networks, so they made us a three-letter network.
Well, and your logo, too, I heard an interesting story that the kind of graphic logo that you got, and again, I'm sure the computer graphics for, or even the logo, is like you'd found, wasn't there a power company or something? Or what's the story behind that logo?
Connecticut Light and Power had something called an Energy Saving Program, ESP. And since we didn't have the money or anything to go off and do animation in New York, they had already done a thing that showed a ball or a planet or something circling the Earth, and it was called, that was our energy saving program. It was going to save the world, I guess.
Right.
And we thought, well, that's kind of interesting, because we didn't know what we call it, the ESP network, as Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, but we didn't have the E at the time. We didn't really, it was very early. And I called to find out who was doing the advertising, and it turned out to be an advertising firm called Bodner, Gorton, and Fox. And I happened to talk to the gentleman, Peter Fox, and said, well, you know, we'd like to use that if we can. Is there something we can do to use the graphic? Obviously, we want to put on our own audio. And he said, I'll tell you what, if I can get the graphic, I want to go to work. He said, I think you have a great idea. He was an avid golfer. He said, this is going to be the greatest thing. He said, I got to be part of it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, you bring that graphic and, you know, let's talk. So the next day he called back and he said, you can have the graphic, no charge. And when do I start? So he brought the graphic, and we built a little 5-minute tape around it, took it to the cable show in early 1979 in Las Vegas in April of 79. And our little booth at the last minute had a crowd standing around it. And our whole pitch was, you see the way that ESP circles the globe, well, ESPN, then we were ESPN, it's going to circle the globe with sports and the satellite, et cetera, et cetera. And people were fascinated. Of course, we had the advantage. We found out things 2 or 3 days or a week before they knew it. So we were the experts and they weren't.
Right.
And they believed us. And, you know, and really we believed it. We knew it just had to work. Sports fans are the most avid, and they cross every demographic, northeast, southwest, young, old, rich, poor, male, female. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
They're all sports fans.
Well, some of the most loyal fans out there. And again, it's a great, great idea. It's one of those ideas when you look at it now in hindsight and retrospect, you're like, well, yeah, why wouldn't it make sense? But given the context of the time, it was like, this is insanity. Why would anybody want to watch sports 24 hours?
Exactly. I've had a couple of people come up to me and say, what's the big deal? Everybody knows sports. Everybody loves sports. Why, you know, why do you get invited to speak here or there? What's, everybody knows this. Of course, those are people who are under 40. Most of them, many times under 20.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, Bill. And what? How can people get in touch with you? I mean, obviously, you're doing speaking and you're talking about this story and you got a book out there. How can people get in touch with you and find out more about your speaking services?
Online, I should say, is ESPNfounder.com. Is the website.
ESPN.
And yeah. That's got a link to Twitter and Facebook and everything else. Twitter handle is @Bill_ESPN. I always hear a lot of interesting things come in. It's fascinating to me who will send some things. Sometimes it's young people, sometimes it's people who've been around a long time. And fortunately, just because of the circumstances, I can talk to all of them because I've been around a long time.
Well, I think you're great, Bill. Again, from a leadership perspective, from an entrepreneurial mindset perspective, I think there's something all of us can take away and learn from your philosophy. I mean, your life has certainly been one that shows that a life of richness can happen when you just put yourself in the arena. You say yes, you try to figure out the details later. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think that's how life probably should be led. And so
I happen to work in television for one affiliate, an ABC affiliate and an NBC affiliate. And I can't tell you how long I have been saying these things. ABC, always be curious. NBC, never be complacent.
I love it.
And I just think, you know, and so I still ask people questions. Sometimes they look at me like, what? But that's okay.
Well, I always wonder, is like, can you instill curiosity in anybody? And I think, again, it's a choice. You can choose to be curious. You can choose to look at any obstacle as a blessing. It's hard to do it when the obstacle is making it hard to breathe. But at the same time, you realize that you have the choice on how you deal with that obstacle. Yeah. Well, Bill, I love it. I love you. I love what you're doing. I love what you've done. And I'm looking forward to see what the future brings, what you bring forward for us. And so I appreciate you coming on the show and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Richard. And who knows, maybe our paths will cross on an airline someplace along
Absolutely.
The way. Could happen.
Absolutely. Thanks,
okay.
Bill.
Okay. Enjoy it, Richard. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for tuning into the show. Go to richardryerson.com or doseofleadership.com and fill out the contact page and reach out to me. Let me know where you're at your leadership journey. Also, if you want access to my brand new online leadership course to help become a better leader, go to legacyleaderblueprint.com. Fill out your email and you gain access to a free 12-minute video that will reveal the top secrets of leadership and also show you how you can gain access, exclusive access, to my online leadership course. That's legacyleaderblueprint.com. Hope to see you on the inside. Thanks for tuning into the show.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.